Welcome to one more episode of The Brand Called You. We've been bringing you some very, very iconic names, talking about their stories. And today we have a very close friend, Pashupati Advani, who all of us call Putti. Putti, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much, Ashutosh. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So Putti has traveled all the way from Bombay to be with us on this show. Putti, you've got an amazing educational background. You're an MBA from Haas Business School in California. You've been to Harvard Business School. Amazing experience of 20 years in the capital markets. You were the youngest ever partner of Bear Stearns. You're the president of the National Stock Exchange. So talk to us a little bit about your early life in the financial markets before we talk about all your other achievements.
Well, you know, I think the first thing that happened was that I have an engineering, actually, undergraduate, which you didn't mention, from Imperial College. Mm-hmm. And then I got applied to MBA school. And I was fortunate enough in those days even to get in directly without any quote-unquote work experience. And so I got into the Berkeley Business School. I got into a couple of others, but I chose to go to Berkeley because I thought to myself, I'm an electronics engineer and I should be close to Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll get a job there. Mm-hmm. So I went to Berkeley. I ended up, instead of doing Silicon Valley type courses, I actually tried to do computer engineering on one of my courses and found it extremely difficult. I ended up doing high-end finance and analytics, and therefore ended up getting a job. And my first job was at Goldman Sachs. So, you know, they say to me that even though you have to move to New York, Goldman is not a company that you ought to reject. So that was my journey into the capital markets. Mm-hmm. I joined Goldman. I was there. I became a bond trader, and then I moved subsequently to Bear Stearns, where I actually traded high yield bonds. And in those days, we were known as Drexel and the Seven Dwarfs when Michael Milken was at his heyday. And so I was in that department, and I became a partner, which was great because our department was actually doing well. So you know, I got some credit for it, and they made me a partner. Subsequent to that, I moved back to India. And
Before we come back to your India story,
yeah,
anything exciting that happened in the ups and downs of Wall Street that you?
Well, it's always a pleasure to make a lot of money on a good trade. You know, actually, while we were there, we had conceived of a couple of trades. One was almost totally my IP, and one was a group IP where we sort of managed to do some interesting swaps and created a lot of money and a lot of value to ourselves. At the time when I was at Bear Stearns, there was a lot of work going on in terms of the mortgages and the high yield bonds and having the same clients, which were the sort of smaller banks and the savings and loans at that time. So basically, we used to swap their mortgages for our high yield bonds. And that was a very exciting program that we got involved in. So I've been to many, many large and small towns in the US meeting savings and loan owners and investment officers, and then trying to persuade them that we're going to make money for them. The difference was it was consistent money, but the thing is, you know, at that time we didn't know those mortgages were good. Had we done the same thing 20 years later, we would have probably got into the subprime crisis. Thank God we didn't. Mm. So, you know.
So then what made you move back to India after such an amazing career in the US?
Well, you know, at some point you have a crossroads. And I think more importantly, it was a thought of where we wanted to bring our children up. Mm-hmm. And I felt that India would be a good place to be. So our decision was actually predicated, believe it or not, on my wife getting my eldest son into nursery school, yeah, which you know how difficult school, yeah, admissions are.
So which year was this?
Well, he was all of three, so it was like in the late 80s. So, you know, she managed to come. She was told that you have to come for personal interview, and if you don't come on this date, there is no chance. So she came and she managed to get him into one particular nursery school in Mumbai. And even that journey has been quite interesting because as a result of him getting in, his other siblings got in. And today I'm actually a trustee of that school simply because we had four children go through that at 3 years each. So we've had a 12-year continuous association with the school. Mm.
Very interesting. You know, a lot of people of your and my vintage moved back in the late 80s, early 90s. We moved back also in the mid 90s. And but this is a topic for some other discussion, some other day,
yeah,
on what really motivated us to move back. I think that's something we can talk about.
I'll tell you honestly, we are first class citizens in India.
Yeah.
We are third class citizens in the US or anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I look today at my friends, say, for example, who've lived in Dubai for 20 and 30 years.
Yeah.
And at the end of when they get to retirement, they're told, okay, you have to leave now. Now, slightly, Dubai is changing its policies. But basically, they're being asked to leave. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've built up friendships, you've built up associations, and then all of a sudden you're told, now, go home.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
And then, I guess, resettling when you come back after so many years.
Correct. And I think it was tough enough then, because I actually remember when I came to India, I had to, I didn't have a telephone and, you know, you had to pay a lot to get a telephone. Then when I got a telephone, it was a 6-digit line and we had to actually hold the phone to get a dial tone at certain times of the day. We didn't get it instantaneously. Things that, you know, is almost unbelievable to believe in our children because, you know, our children say, you know, we have mobiles, we have this, we'd never here see that. So I said, well, that was the way it was.
So coming back to stock markets, you know, you've done so many years on Wall Street and you've done so many years on Dalal Street. How was your experience different in the two markets, other than, of course, the sheer size of the markets?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, my focus in the US was in high yield, which, again, for analysis purposes, you kind of have to do research on the equity to figure out whether the company is going to be able to pay its debt off.
Mm.
However, the animals were similar, but very dissimilar in the sense that Indian equity markets...
You mean animals like bulls and bears or any other animals?
No, the animals meaning the debt and the equity of the bulls and bears.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that over here, the issue is that, you know, I moved back to India and our debt market in India, unfortunately, even today is not, and that's, you know, 30 years later, is not really robust. In the secondary market, it's kind of, you know, patchy. And, you know, that's, I wish it would be there. Numerous ministries and budgets have tried to give incentives, but for some reason it hasn't really worked. So it's a challenge and I don't know what it would take to do it. I mean, every government has got some policy in place to make it happen. So, but I think, you know, when I came back to India, it seemed the right thing to do to get involved in the broking business. So, you know, I picked up a BSE card and then started a Bombay Stock Exchange membership. And then after that, when National Stock Exchange started, I became one of the original members of National Stock Exchange. And then after that, went on actually to be the president of the Brokers Association. So I was on in that space. And at that time, I was on a whole bunch of SEBI committees, also sort of developing the capital markets.
So I'm going to ask you something which may be a little controversial. But, you know, generally the impression in the stock markets has been that, you know, you make a lot of money if you have a tip. And we are beginning to see some major clampdowns on what you would call insider trading in the US with big names being brought up. And I also believe that that is something that's happening in India as well. What are your thoughts on insider trading?
Well, you know, again, the US is, you know, there are very fine lines as to what's an insider trade and what's not.
Correct.
And I think in terms of information, we have the information here, but we've not really used it as much as it's being starting to be used in the US.
Mm-hmm.
In the US, they've kind of, the SEC has kind of made it a business. In SEBI, it's kind of been, you know, has, if a whistleblower comes, then they start an investigation. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they don't. Reality, you know, if I call you up and say, Ashutosh, please buy this stock. You and I have a relationship with each other. I happen to have the information, whatever the so-called confidential information is. You buy it because of our relationship. Have you got the insider information? The answer is no. But you bought the stock and you're the one profiting and I'm not. So the point is that when you have that line and that layer, it makes it very difficult to prosecute. What has happened in India is that promoters have made mistakes of, you know, buying during the quiet period or selling during the quiet period and got into trouble.
Mm.
Or, you know, when they've taken over companies, they've bought stock ahead of the time and got into trouble for that. That is there and it's part of the sort of process of our capital markets growing up. But as I said, even in America, the number of cases that are actually come to fruition, most of them come to settlement, is very few and far between. So, you know, and plus with our legal system being what it is, we would take even longer, so even less likely to settle. Mm. That's the challenge.
So, you know, thousands of young people listen to our podcast and, you know, they'll be listening to your words of wisdom. there is a general impression amongst, and I used to believe it myself when I was young, that the best return is given if you invest in the stock market. And yet, people have made a lot of money and lost a lot of money. So what would your advice be to a young individual starting off and who says, I want to put 1 lakh rupees in the stock market? Because the numbers that I seem to see is that if you keep your money for, say, 10 years, you should get a return of 20% per annum.
See, I'll tell you, what you're suggesting is a capital market theory. That, you know, if the fixed deposit rate is, say, 7% or 6.5%, for example, which is what it is now, the stock market should make you that plus. Mm-hmm. So what has actually happened is that over the time, I think 20 is a bit generous. I think more like, you know, in the low teens would be good because you'd have some premium over the FD rate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people look at the various asset classes, whether it's gold, whether it's art, whether it's real estate. The challenge in India is that most people have put money traditionally into real estate, buying their first home. So it's been skewed. You have 1 crore rupees, but out of 1 crore rupees, 70 lakhs is your house on leverage. And 30 lakhs is your savings, perhaps, when you get to 40 or 50. So I would say to somebody, be patient. I would say today with 1 lakh rupees to invest in one or two of the quality mutual funds and to do it as an SIP. Simply because, you know, you don't want to be looking at the newspaper every day. If you choose to take a portfolio of stocks, buy good quality stocks. It's very difficult to find good quality mid caps and small caps. Those are the so-called tips that you keep getting. So that's money that can go as fast as it comes. But I think that, you know, if you basically look at a theme and say, I believe this is going to happen, and then buy stocks that will benefit from that, that's probably a place to start. But if not, I would suggest with the sum of money that you were talking about to start an SIP of maybe 5 to 10,000 rupees a month and start with the full 1 lakh in a liquid fund and then gradually move between 5 and 10,000 every month to an equity fund. So over a year, it's fully invested. And try to continue next year with another lakh.
So I think we're very fortunate to have someone with your incredible bandwidth of experience in the stock market. So I'm going to ask you a few more questions in this area, more for our young listeners, more for all our millennials who listen to our podcast so regularly. What is a strategy of investment that a young individual should follow who has worked, say, for 5, 7, 8 years and is obviously going to see significant increase in income as time goes, but wants to start making an investment? Do you say just SIP or just mutual funds?
See, again,
or pick up some of the blue chip shares?
Again, it's how much time do you want to give to this effort? See, what traditionally, if somebody is going to put a small amount of money, and I would say small amount of money is less than 5 lakh rupees a year, I would suggest strongly to put the bulk of that in SIPs.
Okay.
I would even suggest at this point to have a combination of debt and equity. So maybe invest in balanced funds because you get a tax benefit from that. So that you have a basic growing and then you also have some equity kicker that will give you the extra return. If you know you are going to get involved and you're going to start looking, then I would say invest in what you know. Invest in businesses that you understand. Invest in managements that you understand. I mean, you know, like for example, in elections, you go and you talk to taxi drivers and rickshaw drivers and ask them for their poll predictions. The same way, go to distributors, go to shopkeepers. Is this product selling? If this product is selling, then look at the numbers, then go back and say, okay, I'm going to buy this. So I think, you know, you have to do some on the ground research.
Correct.
And there's a lot of information available on the net also to give you pointers. You can do SIFs based on PE, based on sectors, based on geographies, whatever you want to do. But I would strongly suggest that if you're going to do individual investing, do it in things that you know, leave the stuff that you don't understand.
Okay, so one last question on the stock market before we move on. Should a young person invest through these multiple websites that are available or should the individual look for a broker? This is how I used to make the investment.
See, again, a broker is obviously going to make some money off it, but you would expect to get advice. Again, it's a function of knowing the broker and saying, is he giving you that value add? My suggestion is start with a broker, understand the process. You can even invest directly, but let the broker make something of the commission that comes from the mutual fund, which you would not really get back anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So allow him to do that and see if he's giving you advice. If he's not giving you good advice, after a year, say, okay, I'm not going to retain you anymore, and your incremental investment can go through directly. So you don't, you know, he doesn't make the money. Mm. But honestly, if the brokerage, if the fund house is paying the broker, it's not coming, it's indirectly coming from your return, but you're not likely to get that money back.
Okay.
So you might as well just use the sources. And, you know, the government is trying to get more people involved because they want people to reach out to the smallest investors. Mm. So there is some incentive. You do need some investment. And a person who is well qualified or is sort of well educated can help you. Because again, this is not your full-time job. Mm. So, you know, it also helps the industry.
Okay. Very interesting. So moving on now, Puti, another big chunk of your business is an India advisory business where you support companies to come into India and you support Indian companies to go out into other markets. Tell us a little bit about this business.
Okay, so I want to split it into two parts. Mm-hmm. The inward into India business has been interesting because what happens is there are a lot of people who are sitting outside who say, we have this business and say we have, I mean, and what I'm seeing right now, for example, is we have manufacturing in China. We want to see whether we can move some of it to India because A, we want a different source of supply. B, we don't know what's happening between President Trump and President Xi. And, you know, we need to basically get out of the way. So they're all looking today, and there's a lot of looking going on in people who want to actually, invest in India on that basis. I have suggested to all of them that you have to look at moving your business. If you're going to move your business, you must also look at India as a market. So if you're going to shift a manufacturing operation from China to India, maybe 10 or 20% for start, you should also definitely look at whether that product has a resale market in India, because I think the domestic business can actually pay for your factory and your export business will be gravy on the top. So that's what's happening right now. There was a little bit of political uncertainty. So people have, the last 3 or 4 months have kind of sat on hold. Now that the BJP government with Narendra Modi as President, Prime Minister Narendra Modi has come in, people feel that the policies will be continued. So I expect people to start doing things in the next 1 to 2 quarters.
So do you see India as a genuine alternative for Chinese companies to move and set up manufacturing?
No, I honestly, it's not for Chinese companies. I honestly feel that Chinese companies are not as welcome here as they are perhaps in Africa or some other countries, because we're definitely not going to allow their border road to come through. So, you know, they're not happy with us, and, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. But it is a source for Europeans and particularly American players who've got manufacturing today in China, who want to shift part of that to India. They don't care that the price is going to be slightly higher, but they do care that, you know, that will get sorted out by the tariffs, because it looks like the tariffs are coming on everything from China. So, you know, that tariff barrier will shift that manufacturing to us.
Yeah.
Again, you know, the way India is set up, you can't start in a day. So a lot of things will take 1 or 2 years as opposed to smaller countries like, and the, you know, the obvious first beneficiaries are companies like Vietnam who are just standing there taking Chinese business, but they don't have the skill set. We have a more expensive labor, but a better skill set.
Yeah.
So we're the place for people to land if you want to be here for the long term. If you want to be short term, you shift it to Vietnam or, you know, even Cambodia or places like that, or Thailand. But I think we are the real place because we have a domestic market that can also drive your business.
Absolutely. So one of the most high profile moves that has taken place is Foxconn to manufacture iPhones here. And I'm sure, I guess, with the current government's policies, more and more people will move here.
Yeah. So, again, Foxconn has decided, what, about 6 months ago. And I think production is currently just kit forming. Mm-hmm. I think the real production will start. Because, again, the good thing about Foxconn coming to India is we're going to need to have a fab in India. And I don't believe we have one as on date. So, you know, that's going to be the next step. And fabs are extremely expensive. And now,
what is fab?
Fab is where they make the chips.
Okay.
You know, you make the chips, they can be programmed by Foxconn, but you need to have a chip manufacturer. So, you know, according to me, that's the critical part, and that's the part that costs money, and that's our valuable foreign exchange going out.
Okay.
So, you know, we need to fill that gap. So either Intel or AMD or Qualcomm is going to do that. Mm. So, you know, we need to get them in line as well.
Okay. And for companies moving out of India, do you think a lot is going to happen? I mean, you know, 8-10 years ago, the high profile acquisitions were the Tatas acquiring Jaguar and Mahindra acquiring other companies.
See, the challenge with people going outside India, there are two lots. One is the large companies, of which Tata's and Mahindra's and, you know, most of the, one of the most prolific has been United Phosphorus, for example, making acquisitions. Mm-hmm. But what has happened is that all of these companies have actually been forced to set up entities outside India, which are driving this process. So there is a Tata Europe, there's a Mahindra Europe, UPL is basically set up in Dubai. So, you know, they're all doing their acquisitions from there because it's still a cumbersome process to write a big check if you're sitting in India. Mm. So that, I agree with the philosophy that we want to have, we don't want foreign exchange to go out. But I think that some of it has become theater of the absurd, and I don't know what the balance is. But the other side of it is that people, for example, who want to have wealth outside India or property outside India, that has been also an interesting market, but it's not a market that I'm specifically involved in. But there are tons of wealth managers who come trying to attract for this $250,000 a year per person, which is what they call the liberal remittance scheme. And, you know, a lot of people are actually doing it. And, you know, there are some families who have actually over the last 10 years put out, say, $10 million, say, 250 times four, and then been able to get a good return on it by doing non-property investments also. Mm. So it's something to think about if you're worth a lot here. But it, again, that's the creamy layer. I don't think it's for everybody.
Correct.
But, you know, again, what I have seen is a lot of families, for example, if they've sold their businesses here, then they have used it and transferred some wealth outside. That's not a space that it's very easy to get into because, you know, once they get where they're going, there are 100 wealth managers who are ready to take them, and, you know, short of providing a couple of introductions, there's very little value add I have. So, yeah. You know.
Okay. Thank you. Moving on, you know, you support a school for underprivileged children. You know, that's a very different aspect of your life.
Well, we my wife and I kind of fell into it because we actually have been blessed with a daughter with special needs. She's now 26 years old, about to be 27. And, you know, so that actually put us in the front line of what education methods are available, mm-hmm. because she has Down syndrome, which means that she has a slightly lower IQ. So we were looking for various tools and methods to see. You know, they talk about early intervention, so we did all the right things that we were supposed to have done. But so in quest of that, we ran into a couple. They were he was an engineer, she was a teacher. They decided at that time they were going to leave Bombay and go, and they bought a piece of land. It's about 7 or 8 hours drive from Chennai in the middle of Tamil Nadu. And so they just set up a school there for farmers' children who were in the locality. And, you know, they were charging them 1 rupee a day simply because they wanted to charge something. And, you know, we're seeing the fruits of that, where, you know, the couple of people have now reached, have gone to college and have graduated and have got jobs. And, you know, we've been helping them over the years with various things. But more than that, it's not only, I mean, monetary support is there. Thank God, God has been good. So it's easy to do that. And also there have been some people who have been helpful along with us. In particular, he was actually set up by the pharmaceutical company Cipla, because he knew one of the promoters, and they actually did a lot in terms of money. So he's never been so much short of money, but he has been short of ideas and, you know, expeditions and things like that. But one of the things that they did was, you know, when we had the typhoon in the tsunami, they're about 20 kilometers from the coast. So he took this band of kids. And they went to the coast and they helped two fishing villages actually get rehabilitated. They got, helped them repair the boats. They helped them get money for new motors, got them back into livelihood in like a month and a half, 2 months time, which I thought was really commendable. And because he had the ability to be able to call on people like us saying, I have a quantifiable target. I need 10 motors. They cost 30,000 rupees each. We need 3 lakh rupees. Fine. Here's a check. Do it. So, you know, because he's been like that, you know, it's a combination of the teaching method, the way they bring up the children, how they, it's like a, I would say, an advisory for life for them. And we're seeing the fruits. I mean, these kids are doing really well.
Amazing. Well, good luck for that. You know, Puti, you have amazing education. You've worked outside India. You've been in the stock market. You've made money. You're probably one of the most well-connected people internationally that I know. What keeps you going every morning?
Well, you know, my wife keeps telling me, why don't we cut down the number of people we know? But I just find that, you know, by meeting new people, you get good ideas. I like to meet millennials too. In fact, at one point, I used to be an alumni interviewer for Haas Business School. So I used to see a lot of people who were like 24 to 28 years old who were applying, who had gone on the shortlist, and you know, see what kind of experience they had and what they were going to do. Unfortunately, now I've been replaced by Skype, so because the bandwidth in India has gotten better, and also you know, funnily enough, the US and California being the absurd place that it is, we were told to ask a certain set of questions, and apparently one of the alumni interviewers asked some different questions to one person, so that person sued, saying I was asked a different set of questions.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, they basically had to get out, get rid of the alumni outreach. So now we do outreach. So I participate in seminars. I go to, you know, study, you know, university trade, what they call trade shows, you know, where people come and ask, how do we get in and things like that. But we're out of the process. But that's a link that I miss. But, you know, so be it. But I mean, you know, it's always interesting. I wish I understood the millennials better, but I'm trying, but I don't think I'm anywhere near that.
So, another question which I'm sure a lot of our viewers would want to know, how important is networking in the lives of individuals who are starting out or who spent a few years?
See, I tell you,
what does networking get for them?
See, you don't realize it upfront when you've just graduated from college and you're looking for a job. But today, the reality is, for example, if there are two people coming out of the same college and one person has quote-unquote influence, they're able to get a better job. And once you've got a better job, your track seems to be easier. Now, it's fair, unfair, it is what it is. I would say in the US, for example, which is the so-called hotbed of no influence, you don't really see the influence peddling till much higher level. But it's there also. At the end of it all, once you get into an organization, into a setup, you kind of have to get into a group of people who are all going to pull each other up. And that's actually the best way to succeed in a professional corporation. So I think that, you know, it is important to be able to network. But again, you don't realize. So you say, why am I going to go to a better named institution today to do my studies? You don't realize the value, because according to me, the education is, you can quietly call it omnis piece. I don't think it makes a difference. But the reality is that when you actually 20 years later, and say you've gone to Harvard Business School, your classmates will be running companies. So then you'll have, if you need to move a job at that time, or you have some difficulty at that time, or you're just looking for a particular track, there are a lot more doors open. So I think that, you know, people don't realize that the value of that when they are in 18, 19, 20, 21. But, you know, it does, according to me, make a difference. It will change. I think social media will have some effect on that. But I don't think, you know, social media is going to connect people to the level of, say, for example, a study group at an HBS, or doing a small class of 4 to 6 people at a Haas Business School. Which will give you, because that's a sort of mind tuning where you spend hours together, and I think that's the differentiator.
Okay, you're a very keen golfer. Does golfing help in networking?
I think it used to. I think it's now perceived as an old person's game. Millennials are certainly not taking into golf as they did when we were younger. The difference is, actually, it was considered to be an expensive sport. It's now a cheaper sport. But, you know, I would say 90% of, say, US golfers are basically hackers and play 4 to 6 times a year. So that's fun. It's helped me, because I think at the time when I was going through my professional career, there were a lot of bankers who I interacted with, and that's helped when I was in the broking business. And so, you know, it has helped me. Again, I think one has to evaluate whether it helps somebody today. I don't think there's any harm, but I think that, you know, it is time consuming, and, you know, people therefore find it difficult to take that much time out.
So given all the years of experience, think about what would be your biggest learning from your biggest failure.
My biggest learning from my biggest failure is never to... I always felt that things would be okay. And obviously, like everyone else in life, you'd go through a couple of downs. So, you know, I think that the point is that I've always been in a situation where I've been reactive rather than proactive. I think the learning should be that I ought to be more proactive. I still haven't changed, because I've always believed that there's too much in the world to think about, and it's kind of easier to wait to get smacked and then figure out what to do. Unfortunately, that's not the way to live, and I think that people who are more proactive and more planned have perhaps better outcomes than me.
Okay. So one last question. If a young person wants to start off and make a career in the capital markets, what should they be looking at in terms of either qualifying or in terms of the experience?
Well, you know, I think I'm presuming when you say capital markets, you're talking about being the brains of the business rather than the brawn of the
Correct.
Business. Because I think in every firm, there's enough brawn. There are relationship managers at banks. There are relationship managers wealth managers who are out there trying to capture, as I said, I had mentioned earlier in the talk that, you know, they're out to capture the marginal wealth from people. I think that, you know, there are some professional qualifications that can be done. One of the most powerful, which unfortunately I am not, is a CFA. Mm-hmm. I think being a good chartered accountant also helps, but then you have to take a choice whether you want to stay in practice or you want to move to the financial markets. Today, there's so much work going on for CAs that it's very difficult to pull them. But I think having a chartered accountancy does help, because it helps you analyze business balance sheets. And so I think that, you know, if you have that natural instinct and you need to like numbers, but I'll tell you the reality. I think if you want to be successful in the share market, you need to have it in your blood. You need to be looking at the pages. You need to be looking at TV. You need to be studying. Before, maybe when you're in college. And I think those are the people that succeed, because you have a passion for their business. And like everything else, if you have a passion, you'll succeed. And money will follow.
Thank you, Puti, very much.
Thank you very much.
Very, 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 very helpful and a lot of information. So we've been listening to Mr. Pashupati Puti Advani sharing all his experience on the capital markets and how he sees a lot of businesses evolving between India and the rest of the world. If you've enjoyed seeing our podcast, visit us at www.tbcy.in and send us your thoughts. Thank you again.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.